This is the Voice of America, Studio One. Alaska, the Last Frontier, a program commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase by the United States. Today, a portrait in sound of the legends of Alaska, the third in a series of programs on the history, the people, the legend, and the promise of the 49th state. Here is Rhett Turner.
What American hasn't heard about that bunch of the boys who were whooping it up at the Malamute Saloon? Or of those strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold? Those are famous lines from poems by Robert W. Service, the poet of the Klondike, who followed the great gold stampede of 1898 into the Yukon. And for half a century, American boys have read of John Thornton and the great dog Buck in Jack London's Call of the Wild, or the Alaska stories of Rex Beach. These authors have drawn from people and experiences bigger than the lives of ordinary men, from human exploits and a land that almost staggered the imagination. And along with the tales of the American West that came before them, they add an immense chapter to the legend of America. No exploits of men are more adventurous and colorful than those from the great land of the North, of the Yukon and Alaska.
As you know, many of them picked up these names from the Wild West.
That's Pete Walsh of three generations of gold mining Walshes in Nome.
There was the Bull Moose Kid, Champagne Kid, Two-Story Hans, Sleepy Pete, Brocky Mike, Too Much Johnson, Not Enough Johnson, Wing Dam Johnson, Strawberry John. And when you often hear their real name, why, you wouldn't know who you were talking about.
Pete grew up in Nome, meeting and hearing the rough characters who prospected for gold during the great mining days there.
One in particular was the Champagne Kid, and his real name was Alfred Hansen. He got the name of Champagne Kid when he was mining up in the Candle area, and he happened to strike a real rich deposit, and he took out quite a few $1,000s in a very few days. So he dropped everything he was there and took all his boys to town and treated them all to champagne. And they had quite a party for about 5 days, and they ran out of money, so they decided to go back to the claim. When he got back there, he found it had been jumped and somebody else was working it. Never got the claim back.
The Champagne Kid had neglected to stake his claim, to drive survey stakes into the ground around the limits of the ground he was mining. Such things as this could easily have started a small war among the gold miners of the early 20th century in Alaska. Though it didn't in this case, there were tales of fighting, thievery, frontier justice, and heroism that could and did fill many a book. Today we'll try to tell you about some of them. I spent the early part of the 1967 summer visiting people all over Alaska. Everywhere I went, there was a firm handshake and a hearty smile. In a land a third the size of all the rest of the United States, there are only some 270,000 people. They have room, lots of it, and land, lots of it. Though life is hard in the extreme climate of the Arctic, they still represent a pioneer spirit of hardy independence and self-reliance. The original Alaskans, Eskimos, and their relatives, the Aleuts, have inhabited the Arctic coast for some 10,000 years, long before white men came as trappers and gold prospectors. They've survived through reliance on each other and with a happy disposition needed in the rigorous climate. In Barrow, the northernmost settlement on the American continent, I went to the house of Mrs. Sadie Neocock, who for years has been a good Samaritan or helper to the little Eskimo village of 2,000. Sadie has 12 children, 9 boys and 3 girls, ranging in age from 4 to 26. Most Eskimo families are large. Sadie Neocock is not only the chief welfare worker for the village of Barrow, she is now the village magistrate. When someone breaks the law, he is brought before Sadie for arraignment. One time, her younger brother appeared.
A game warden brought my brother in for killing a cow moose out of the out of season. And I didn't let on that it was my brother. So I took care of him. And later on, I did tell the game warden that was my little brother who had about 13 kids. And I had to confiscate the meat off of him for punishment out of my little brother. Later on, I said, now I guess you're going to have to take all this meat back that I confiscated off this man. No, he said, I have to give it to the welfare worker. And what is she supposed to do? What is the person, the welfare worker, supposed to do? Well, she's supposed to distribute it as she pleases. So I told him that I was also a welfare worker. But it all works out, you know, in a matter where I'm the magistrate and also the welfare worker. And in cases where there's a big family, a man, a supporter, may have to go to jail, I tell them right or wrong, and as mad as they are at me sometimes for sentencing a person, then I have to turn right around and bring the wife in and sometimes get welfare care for them. Mm-hmm. Oh, it isn't an easy job.
What did you do with the meat from that cow moose that you took from your brother?
I asked my brother, that little brother of mine, now how much meat do you have at your house? Well, that was all we had. Well, how many in your family? He says, we got 13 kids and the 14th one's coming on. Well, this meat is left in my care. Now, knowing that you do need part of that meat, I'll give it to you. So I gave him part of the hind quarter and divided the rest to the families who were in need. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of a magistrate I am. A welfare worker.
One of the most colorful legends of the Eskimo is that of Aisenach and the Little Men. M.R. Marston, known to the Eskimos and all Alaska as Muktuk Marston, organized the coastal natives into a territorial guard during World War II. I met Muktuk in Anchorage, and he told me the story of the Little Men.
There's a legend of the Little Men. Aisenach is the chief of the Little Men. His name is Aisenach. And at one time, the sun and moon were wed, according to legend, and round the world they went for eons of time, arm in arm as man and wife. And one time, the sun said to the moon, I'm going down to Cape Prince of Wales. And the moon said, you better not do it. The little men will get you. And the sun said, I'm going down to Cape Prince of Wales, and peeled off and went down. That's a village, most westerly village on the North American continent, right opposite Diomede Island. And there he met the little men, where a great struggle took place. A lake was created. After 3 days, the sun extracted itself and rejoined the moon. Now, the moon said something that I think should not have been said. The moon said, I told you so. Well, Aisha came back to the village. He said, what happened here? They said the sun called. Why didn't you keep the sun? I've never met him. Now, Aisenach knew Jesus and Caesar and Napoleon, all those men he knew. He had conquered the sound barrier long before our flyboys ever did. All those things he had done. And he had never met the sun. They said we tried, but he was too mighty. We couldn't hold him. Aisenach, knowing all, said the sun will return. Now, he stood 1,000 years on the shores of that lake where the sun met the little men. He was lean and ruddy and muscle, and he stood for 1,000 years on the shores of the lake waiting for the sun to come back. And at the end of 1,000 years, the sun said to the moon, I'm going back to Cape Prince of Wales, and peeled off, no argument with this gal anymore. It went right down there. And a half a mile from that lake is a bigger lake where the sun met Aisenach and all these mighty men. So mighty were the little men, the sun has never rejoined the moon. That's a great guy.
Muktuk Marston and the legendary Little Men of the Eskimo. The Indians who lived in the interior of Alaska and along the southeastern coastal area were for the most part a peaceful people. There was no great warring among the aboriginal nations, though the Tlinkets did show themselves to be smart tacticians in their skirmishes with Russian traders in the early 1800s. One of the greatest monuments to all American Indian cultures is the totem pole and totemic designs. The Tlinkets were the original totem carvers, and the legend of their culture exists today in the great silent carvings of giant red and white cedar trees. The Tlinkets were divided into two major families, the ravens and the eagles, and you'll always see symbols of these birds in their designs. It began as a trickle, like a tiny spring that wells up from the rocks of mountaintops and begins to tumble downhill. Then it picked up speed as others joined it along the way. That's the way word of gold in the Yukon and Alaska affected men to the south. The trickle began in 1880, but it wasn't until 1898 through Skagway and Dyea, Alaska, over the brutal Chilkoot and White Passes, that the rush for gold became a torrent of humanity. Men from the sands of the Sunland, men from the woods of the West, men from the farms and the cities into the Northland we pressed. Graybeards and striplings and women, good men and bad men and bold, leaving our homes and our loved ones crying exultantly, "Gold!" The words of Robert Service, who joined the gold rush across Chilkoot Pass in 1898. 1,100 pounds of supplies had to be transported across the mountains for each man in order for him to survive one winter in the Klondike country. He was an eternal optimist, the gold miner. He fought his way through winter blizzards and surface slush of the brief summer, thawing permanently frozen ground to dig a hole to bedrock, sometimes over 30 meters down. Finding nothing, he climbed out, packed up, and moved on. Next hole. Sometimes frontier life grew faster than law and order could catch up with it. One of the most colorful stories, and true to the letter, came from Nome, where a powerful political boss and mining company owner managed to get a corrupt judge to decree by law that certain profitable mining claims be taken from individuals and given to the company for exploitation. The mining boss was Alexander McKenzie, and the judge was Arthur H. Noyes. Here is Maurice Kelleher of Irish descent, who is today's district judge in Nome, as he explained to me what happened.
This judge, he set up a receivership on all the ground and appointed his good friend McKenzie as the receiver. And for several years, they mined some of the best claims here and stole several million in gold, which was never properly accounted for. Later, the judge was impeached, and McKenzie went to jail for 6 months. And Judge Wickersham came down from Circle to Nome and later became our first father, as it were, of statehood and a great man for Alaska and a very famous man.
Did you get
for
bloody?
Many years. During this legal fight that was here in Nome, of course, it was bloody, and you had gunmen from all the Old West. It took years of law, of litigation, of course, and the miners, including John Dexter and some of these Lane and some of the very famous men, they had to send messengers secretly to San Francisco by boat to try and get some justice. And their delegates came back with authority to overrule Judge Noyes, which he ignored. And it took quite a little bit of legal red tape to get the whole thing unraveled and eventually get this receivership set up. But the miners, in the meantime, were ready to fight for their possessions. Those who hadn't lost the ground were ready to fight. And you had hired gunmen on both sides. And it was a very serious situation, and quite a few people were killed here. And you had a lot of gunmen in Nome in 1999 and 1900 and afterwards. Mm-hmm. But actually, this is covered very well in The Spoilers by Rex Beach, who was a miner here. And it was on that story that he became famous. And it's very true.
Before law and order arrived in the early 1900s, frontier justice was quick and rough. A group of miners would gather in judgment of an offense and quickly mete out punishment to fit the crime. Murder was punished by immediate hanging. Lesser crimes, according to their seriousness, by such things as whipping or banishment. Bobby Sheldon was a young man in Skagway when one of the most notorious of crooks, Soapy Smith, was shot in a street fight with vigilantes. Bobby saw that, but became famous himself for something else. Having never seen an automobile before, in 1905, he built the first automobile in the territory of Alaska. Here's Bobby Sheldon, now 84, as he described for me why he built it.
I became quite famous because it was referred to as the first girl trap in Alaska. And as a trapper, I wasn't very successful because the girl that I built it for turned around and married the boy with a horse and buggy and left me out on a limb with the automobile. I was engineering the power plant and tied up there at nights, you know, and you can't get away. And this girl I was keeping company with, I had some pretty keen competition, too, the good-looking son of a prominent doctor there. And the doctor had a swanky horse and buggy. Rubber-tired buggy, if you please. And he'd let his son have this horse and buggy in the evening when he wasn't using it. He'd drive up and get my girl and drive down by the power plant and toodly-doo or rub it in as they go by, you know. And anybody that never was in love just wouldn't quite understand what a guy goes through under certain circumstances.
Oh,
and so I finally figured I had to do something pretty desperate in order to compete with that bloody horse and buggy. So I had this little gas engine that came out of a boat, and there was all kind of discarded buggies in Skagway in those days, if you needed them. And so I got one and fixed it up to put this little marine engine in it, and the thing ran. Well, I sure dealt that boy with the horse and buggy some misery for a while. I sent out to Sears Roebuck and got one of these little rubber bulb squawker horns that they had in those days and fastened it on the thing, and I'd drive up to her house, and I say my girl advisedly because she said she loved me better than she did him, but whatever she was telling him, I never did find out. However, I found out in a roundabout way.
When she married him.
Yeah, so I drove up the house each time, and she'd come flying out when she heard that horn honking, and we'd drive away and leave that kid with the horse and buggy sitting there, chewing his fingernails to the knuckles, I suppose, or whatever you do. And the ultimate answer was that I didn't find out for a couple of months after it was all over where the fall down came. Because in Skagway in those days, the same as in many towns all over the world, there's always these kindly old ladies making it their business to see that a girl doesn't marry the wrong boy. And people were referring to me as a genius. They said a boy that could build an automobile that never seen one, why, he's a genius. I didn't even know what a genius meant. I was interested in something much more potent, what a genius might be. So anyway, come to find out, these kindly old ladies were telling this girl's mother that they better think this thing through pretty carefully because they must remember there was a very narrow line of demarcation between genius and insanity. And this little girl didn't want to be the mother of a lot of geniuses, so she got out while the going was good and married the boy with a horse and buggy.
Among the legends of the 49th state are stories about the daring exploits of bush pilots. In the 1920s and 30s, these daredevils of the air literally opened up all of the interior with their small single-engine airplanes on skis and pontoons. They flew in any weather and landed on snow and ice and on the hundreds of bays and lakes dotting the country. The names are many, among them Carl Eielson, Russ Merrill, Noel Ween, Joe Crossan, Bob Reeve, and Harold Gillam, just to begin with. Typical is this experience of Al Lyle of Copper Center. Here's how he told it to me.
I had a trip from Copper Center to
Valdez to catch the boat, and I had an invalid woman and her husband. Stopped at Valdez, and I picked up a fellow by the name of Jack Coates. He was an engineer on the Alaska Road Commission. He wanted to come to Anchorage, and we had a Signal Corps weather report of Clearing Unlimited over here. And we started right across Prince William Sound, and I got over to Portage, and it was socked in, so I swung around, and I got on down to Seward and got on the railroad and sneaked in along the railroad tracks, and I got in over turning an arm down here. It was in February, and there was icebergs running all over this bay here, and I got down right on the water, about 20 feet off the water, and I see it was going right to the water, so I found a hole and I circled, got up on the top side in the sunshine, and I had gone along like I had better sense. All of a sudden, top of number one cylinder flew off. And there I was, on the top side, out over the turning an arm there. It was a high spring, with number one cylinder off. And I had about, 600-700 RPMs, is all I had. So I opened the window and stuck my head out so I could see where the water and the fog, the difference between the two. And finally made the shore, and on the shore was all big ice cakes, you know, and couldn't land there. So then I saw the telephone line on the railroad track. And then there was a section house. So I bent it over in a tight turn, and I was following the hill along, and I saw a little pothole. And I sat in that pothole and I run out in the brush about, 50, 100 feet. Never scratched a thing. And this fellow walked back to this section house. And I drained the oil out of the engine and checked it over and was tied it down, put the motor tent on. And he come back and he says, "Well, there's a plate of ham and eggs waiting for us over here." And just then, Harold Gillum went over. He was on the top side. And, of course, he had the only Hornet engine up around this country at that time. You could recognize the noise. That was the time that he went in the inlet. He got circling around up here and run out of gas. And he went out here in the inlet. And there was a pilot by the name of Steve Mills. He lived in the Parsons Hotel at that time. He had a room facing the inlet. He looked out the window and he see this airplane and a couple of fellas sitting on an iceberg out there. So he alerted the fire department. And they put a boat in the water and went out there and got a line on the airplane and picked the fellas off the ice. And that was Harold Gillum.
And one of the most famous stories of Alaska is this one. It's about a common law wedding on the Koyukuk Trail in 1898. Here's Alaska's best-known storyteller, Gerrit Heine Snyder, originally from the Netherlands, to tell it.
We had a man down there, kind of a lanky fella, and his name was McGinnis, we learned later on. But he was originally called the Farmer. Now, the reason they called him the Farmer was because of that he was always continuously talking about sheep and goats and horses and all kinds of animals. But not only that he had loved animals so much, that he also got to be one of our foremost dog mushers. In fact, McGinnis was the first man that thought and found out that to have a dog team that don't fight too much among themselves is to have them all of one family. In fact, towards the end, he had 42 dogs, and they were all related. So there was little or no fighting among them. He got from the United States government and from Canada one of the greatest, biggest mail carrier jobs in the territory of Alaska. On one occasion, while he stood down there at the dock waiting at Skagway for his mail, down the gangplank came female. A very charming young lady came down the gangplank and handed him a letter, and it stated that her name was so-and-so-and-so-and-so, and that she was a school teacher, and that she needed transportation to go down to the Kuskokwim. So instead of all male, he had also female on the sled. And when on the way to the different places in Alaska, boy means girl, and It came so that this young man fell in love with the girl, and she very much liked him. But, of course, in the wilds of Alaska, it is pretty hard to get a marriage license, let alone to get a preacher to marry you. And one occasion when they were down the trail, way down in the distance was a little man came up the trail, and McInnes says to this girl, to this young lady, he says, "Well, if you want to get married, here's a good chance. There is Franz Pete. He can do most anything. He can marry us, too." So he says, "Hello, Pete." "Oh, there, farmer. How are you doing?" "Well," he says, "I have my sled down here and my dogs. I'm delivering the mail." And he says, "I wonder if you could marry us. Can you marry us?" "Yes." So they stood down there, and the girl spoke first. 10 miles from the Yukon, on the shore of this lake, I, Agnes McGinnis, to a husband will take. There is no preacher, and it ain't got a ring, but it doesn't amount to a damn. It's just the same thing. Now, on the sled of a dog team sled is a stick on the right-hand side known as the G-pole. When you tell the leader, G, he goes to the right, and you press with your stick, and you go, "Ha!" So McGinnis says, "I swear by my G-pole under this tree that I, McGinnis, to Agnes, a true and lawful husband will be, to love and protect this maiden so fair from the sourdough stiff on the Kiakuk Trail." And old Franz Pete says, "And for 2 bits, which is a quarter, in Chichoka money, I unite this couple in the bond of holy matrimony. He being a farmer and she being a teacher, by heck, I done the job as good as any old preacher. Thank you."
And would you believe that the record of that marriage is recorded in the pages of the Yukon Press, the issue of March 17, 1899? Tall tales, those you've heard today are certainly that. And legends, yes. Just a small sample of the many legends of Alaska, the way they were told to me. The kind of things that people could write books about, and did. The legends are born of a different and exciting land, the great land of the frontier, where people are of an uncommon kind, the kind you write stories about. Alaska, the last land frontier in the territory of the United States, a 20th century frontier full of the same sort of strong and daring pioneers who came to the Americas centuries ago and blazed onto one frontier land after another. But Alaskans didn't know they were pioneers at all. They went for other things, to make a better living, on an adventurous journey following an eternal rainbow of hope. It took strength and courage and faith to go into this wilderness. They thought at first that they went for gold, but it turned out to be for something else. Poet Robert Service said it. "It's the great big broad land way up yonder. It's the forests where silence has lease. It's the beauty that thrills me with wonder. It's the stillness that fills me with peace. I'd like to go back again."
Alaska, the Last Frontier, the third of four programs about the history, the people, the legend, and the promise of the colorful 49th state. Next week, a portrait in sound on the promise of Alaska. This program was written and narrated by Rhett Turner. This is Jack Weitzel speaking for the Voice of America, Studio One.